Christian author Chuck Colson said the following: when fear becomes pervasive, someone will come along on a white horse and say, "I'll bring you order. 5 more years of chaos in America, and someone on a white horse will offer to bring order out of chaos. If that happens, the result will bring tyranny." It was Colson. Here's a new right leader. His name is Paul Weyrich, Roman Catholic. This is what he said: as long as cultural deterioration continues to manifest itself in horrible ways, evangelicals will be compelled to get active, even in ways that appall them. They'll feel absolutely obliged to do so. Interesting. And finally, this is a quote from former Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg: while the Constitution protects against the invasion of individual rights, it is not a suicide pact. At first, there were only rumors, cold whispers that rumbled within their breasts. Then, with the first arrests, their words were carried on cries. They took E's father. They took him at night. He was allowed only a suitcase and toothbrush. E wept until the morning. Then a curfew dropped around them. With every sunset, thousands huddled inside their homes, prisoners of half the earth's rotation. Suddenly, the orders to evacuate broke the huddles. None could believe that this was happening, not here, not in their own country, not when they had done nothing wrong. As they scrambled, their hearts ground into low gear. Many were forced to sell homes, businesses, and property immediately and at unfair prices. Cameras, binoculars, shortwave radios, firearms were snatched out of their hands with no recompense. All they had worked for all their lives were reduced to what could be carried in their arms. The children were scared, not because they understood, but because they felt the fears of those whom they loved and trusted. Not until the soldiers came with rifles and bayonets did many of the children wrap around the arms and legs of their elders and cry. They were herded into buses, into trains that murmured and whined, mothers, fathers, the elderly, the infirm, who murmured and whined with it. Little S, only 8, sat with her family on a train for 3 days. The shades were pulled down. They were forbidden to look out the windows. All, about 120,000, were taken to concentration camps. Jay, 16, got off the bus into a field of mud. Before him was barbed wire, watchtowers, and soldiers with guns. Ordered inside, they were warned, if you tried to leave, you would be shot. Some families had to live in horse stalls that still smelled. Young Y saw teeth marks along the door of their new home. Others were crammed in long wooden buildings that looked like old chicken coops. Inside, families were cramped into small cubicles that had no ceilings. Every sound, from the cry of a baby to the prayers of an adult, echoed. There were long lines for latrines, which were outside in the hot and in the cold. Their protests climaxed into nothing but bursts of angry air. They cited the law, which forbade the imprisonment of people who had committed no crimes, were proven guilty of no acts, who had no trials. But the judges closed their ears to their cries and their eyes to the law. D was 12 years old when they took him and his family away. He was 15 when he was finally freed. Feeling like strangers, they returned home. Their address, 2002 Pine Street, San Francisco, California. When the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, their planes destroyed not only America's Pacific Fleet, but any notion that Americans could always count upon the courts to protect their rights. The imprisonment of tens of thousands of American men, women, and children proved that during a time of crisis, our constitutional protections aren't worth the paper they're written on. Commenting about what happened in the Second World War, a couple of constitutional scholars in a book wrote the following: in future wars, no persons belonging to racial, religious, cultural, or political minorities can be assured that community prejudice and bigotry will not express itself in a program of suppression justified by military necessity, with the resulting destruction of his basic rights as a member of a free society. Bills of rights are written in a large part to protect society against precisely such a possibility. And insofar as they fail to do so, they lose their meaning. See, the whole purpose of the Bill of Rights is to protect, exactly to protect against something like this. And then yet when it happened, boom, completely, totally ignored. What happened in World War II should dismiss any belief that the United States could not fill its prophetic role. I mean, if fear of Japan could cause this nation to take, 120,000 men, women, and children who had done nothing wrong, who had committed no crimes, and locked them into concentration camps, if fear of Japan would do that to us, what would the fear of the Almighty God Himself cause us to do? After each perceived security crisis, warned former U.S. Supreme Court Justice William Brennan, the United States has remorsefully realized that the abrogation of civil liberties was unnecessary, but has proven unable to prevent itself from repeating the era when the next security crisis came along. Now, the background to this constitutional outrage against these Japanese citizens, it was quite simple. I mean, the bombing of Pearl Harbor, besides killing thousands of sailors, left the West Coast vulnerable to Japanese attack. You know, it's fascinating. I was in Pearl Harbor last year, first time I was ever over there. And they take you out to the memorial over the USS Arizona. And people been there, and you walk out, and the thing that was so amazing is you still, oil is still leaking out of the boat. And that's powerful. That's powerful. That says, to me, that was one of the most powerful. See, the oil just brings the reality of it home to you. Meanwhile, besides killing thousands of American soldiers, that attack left the West Coast vulnerable. The whole Pacific Fleet was destroyed. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of Japanese Americans lived on the coast, whose hearts were with the Stars and Stripes, whose hearts were with the rising sun. Who could tell? So what was the answer? Round them all up. A Jap is a Jap, warned General John D. Witt. It makes no difference whether he is an American citizen or not. He is still a Japanese. The Japanese race is an enemy race. And while many have become Americanized, the racial strains are undiluted. Sabotage and espionage will make problems as long as he is allowed in this area. I'm for catching every Japanese in America, Alaska, Hawaii now, and putting them in concentration camps, said Congressman John Rankin on the House floor. Let's get rid of them now. California Governor Colbert Olson said this, quote, "There's a tremendous volume of public opinion now developing against the Japanese of all classes. That is, aliens and not aliens, to get them off the land. And in Southern California around Los Angeles, in that area too, they want and they are bringing pressure on the government to move all Japanese out. As a matter of fact, it's not being instigated or developed by people who are not thinking, but by the best people of California." Now, one of the major purposes of an independent federal judiciary is to protect against majority rule. See, our founding fathers did not like the concept of democracy. Democracy can be a very dangerous thing. Just because you've got a bunch of people making laws and rules doesn't mean they're going to make good rules. They sometimes called it mobocracy. You know, the idea that a bunch of, you know, that just because you're... See, people are under the notion that just because they're under laws that they make, that makes that they're automatically free. That's not the way it is. Democracy can be a very dangerous thing. It was, I think, Winston Churchill who said, "Democracy is a lousy form of government, but it's better than any other type that has been tried." Because the masses don't necessarily want what's the best. And so the whole idea of the government, and our government, was you've got this court, these people who are not elected. You see, you don't like the president, you don't like your legislature, he votes something you don't like, you go to the voting booth, and you can throw the bums out. That's the way it works. That's the way it's supposed to work, because the people are supposed to have a say in the government. But at the same time, too, you've got a court. You've got this court which is insulated, which is protected from the mob, from the masses, who might get hysterical, who might get fearful and want to do something wrong or bad, and you've got the court here which doesn't have to answer to anybody in the voting booth. They're voted in for life. And ideally that is done to protect them from politics. Now you got a governor, you got a senator, he wants to vote. You know, I talked about this yesterday. It's one of the weaknesses of democracy. You've got Senator A, and there's a bill being passed, or there's a bill in, you know, up. And Senator A knows very well that this bill is bad. This bill is bad for America. All the way around, it's bad. But Senator A is getting ready to get to face an election in 6 months. And competing with Senator A is Candidate B. And Candidate B knows that this is a hot-button issue. So he's riling up the masses, saying, you know, we've got to vote this, and Senator A might not vote for this, and so forth. And then Senator A knows, if I don't vote for this bill, I'm going to get voted out. Senator A, he wants to stay in. He likes being a senator, whatever. So what does Senator A do? Senator A votes for this bill, knowing it's lousy, only because of politics. He doesn't want to get voted out of office. That is, in a nutshell, one of the inherent weaknesses of democratic system. And so we've got checks and balances in our Republican form of government, and you've got this judiciary which is above and beyond it. They, ideally, the courts can make a decision and nobody could come along and do anything to them. And that's the way it's supposed to be. Yet, when the constitutionality of the curfew and then the evacuation and imprisonment of these Japanese Americans reached the U.S. Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the government, that Roosevelt's government, was in its rights to do what it did, despite the clear teaching of the Constitution, which says, quote, that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. In other words, there's laws in the land that the government has to follow before it can arrest you, before it can imprison you, before it can take away your property. Due process of law. No person shall be deprived of life, liberty, and due process of law. And despite the promise that no state can deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protections of the laws. The arrest, evacuation, and imprisonment of 120,000 people who had been convicted of no crimes, had no trials, in other words, had not been given any due process of law, but simply because of their ancestry, was nevertheless validated by the high court. And that was only just, you know, a few years ago under the Reagan administration. Did they finally admit that they were wrong? But back then, they just did it. In one of the cases, Hirabashi versus the United States, one of the cases that went to the Supreme Court, which dealt in the beginning just with the curfew imposed upon the Japanese, the court said, quote, the distinctions between citizens solely because of their ancestry are by their very nature odious for a free people, whose institutions are founded on the doctrine of equality. For that reason, legislative classifications or discriminations based on race alone has been held to be a denial of equal protection. Distinctions based on color and ancestry are utterly inconsistent with our traditions and ideals. They are at variance with the principles for which we are now waging war. We cannot close our eyes to the fact that for centuries the old world has been torn by racial and religious conflicts and has suffered the worst kind of anguish because of inequality of treatment for different groups. There was one law for one and one law for another. Nothing is written more firmly into our law than the compact of the Plymouth Voyagers to have just and equal laws. Close quote. Wonderful. Nevertheless, due to the emergency situation caused by the war, the court said, we conclude that it was within the constitutional powers of Congress and the executive arm of the government to prescribe this curfew order for the period under consideration. Then it goes on and on and on. In other words, distinctions on race and all this stuff, it's horrible, it's terrible, it's against everything we stand for and everything we believe, but we're going to do it anyway. In another case, Korematsu versus the United States, which dealt with the evacuation and the imprisonment and the confiscation of their property, it's quite fascinating. At the Smithsonian, they've got a whole floor, or they got a whole wing at the Smithsonian dealing with this evacuation, and it's very powerful to see it. In Korematsu versus the United States, the court acknowledged, you know, again, that hardships, quote, imposed upon a large group of American citizens have been imposed upon them. But hardships are part of war, and war is an aggression of hardships. All citizens, both in and out of uniform, feel the impact of the war in greater or lesser measure. You know, compulsory exclusions of large groups of citizens from their homes, except in under circumstances of direst emergency and peril, is inconsistent with our basic constitutional governmental institutions. But under conditions of modern warfare, when our shores are threatened by hostile forces, the power to protect must be commensurate with the threatened danger. So the basic idea is under the threat and danger of war, we are justified in taking these extraordinary measures. In a vigorous dissent, Justice Robert Jackson, listen to what he wrote. He warned that this decision was a subtle blow to liberty. A military order in an emergency, he said, however unconstitutional, will not likely last longer than the military emergency itself. But then he says this, but once a judicial opinion rationalizes such an order to show that it conforms to the Constitution, or rather rationalizes the Constitution to show that the Constitution sanctions such an order, the court for all times has validated the principle of racial discrimination in criminal procedure and of transplanting American citizens. The principle then lies about like a loaded weapon ready for the hand of any authority that can bring forward a plausible claim of an urgent need. In other words, what he basically said is you've just set the precedent. Let there be another emergency, and we can again go ahead and just trample on constitutional rights. See, once the principle is established that an urgent need allows the rights of one group to be trampled on, what would stop the urgent need in another situation from trampling upon the rights of another group? And then I said that over more than 40 years later, the United States has admitted its mistake. And under the Reagan administration a number of years ago, they actually gave reparations back to these people and formally apologized. I mean, 40 years later, the lesson remains clear. Under the right conditions, nobody is safe. Constitution or no Constitution. See, this concept, there is a concept in the government known as emergency powers. Clinton evoked it just a year or two ago when he got money to help Mexico from totally collapsing. Congress, the government, the normal process of government, he didn't have to follow. And he was able to get that money, claimed emergency powers. And the concept of emergency powers allows the circumvention of the Constitution. And it has been used numerous times. And it's interesting, but way back in the earliest days of America, the principle behind emergency powers was enunciated by Alexander Hamilton in the Federalist Papers. And we talked about the Federalist Papers. Let's listen to the logic here, because it really makes good sense. Alexander Hamilton, in many ways, I think, was one of the founding geniuses behind America. He probably would have gone on to be the president, except he got in a duel with Aaron Burr over something, and Aaron Burr pulled the pistol out first and blew him away. So that ended Alexander Hamilton. I mean, when we think we deal with our political differences, they shot each other about that, duels. Hamilton wrote, quote, "The circumstances that endanger the safety of nations are infinite, and for this reason, no constitutional shackles can be wisely imposed upon the power to which the care is committed." This is one of those truths which, to a correct and unprejudiced mind, carries its own evidence along with it, and may be obscured that cannot be made plainer by argument or reasoning. It rests upon axioms, as simple as they are universal. The means ought to be proportioned to the end. The person from whose agency the attainment of any end is expected ought to possess the means by which it is to be attained. Now, they kind of talked funny back then and wrote funny back then, but in the end, the bottom line, if you're given a job to do something, if you're given a job to protect the safety of this country, if you're given a job to protect the well-being of this country, then you need to be allowed to do whatever you have to do. Constitution or no constitution, rights or no rights, to attain that end. And this principle has allowed the government to go outside the Constitution numerous times. This isn't anything new. I mean, the ink was hardly dry on the document when in 1792, George Washington used emergency powers, circumvented the Constitution, to put down a civil, to put down basically what's called the Whiskey Rebellion. People didn't want, there was a federal tax on whiskey. People didn't want the tax. George Washington sent troops in to quell the rebellion. With the Alien Act of 1789, Congress gave the president almost unlimited power to, quote, direct the conduct of foreign nationals of nations hostile to the United States. In other words, if they were having trouble with France or England or someone and these foreigners lived here, the president had control, do whatever you want with them, whatever you think is necessary. Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, who was always very, very fearful of federal power, very, very fearful of federal power, once he became the president, he completely usurped Constitution to do what he wanted. I mean, the Louisiana Purchase. The Louisiana Purchase was totally illegal. No, totally illegal. Totally outside the bounds of the Constitution. But he used emergency powers and did it anyway. In the wars of 1812 and 1847, emergency powers regarding shipping, trade, and maritime commerce were enacted that allowed the government time and again to go outside the Constitution. Interesting enough, probably no president trampled on the Constitution more than Abraham Lincoln did during the Civil War. I mean, Lincoln just trounced upon freedoms during the Civil War. And he rationalized it. He said, I got to violate the Constitution in order to save it. He said, I felt that measures otherwise unconstitutional might become lawful by becoming indispensable to the preservation of the Constitution through preservation of the nation. He just went outside of it to do what he had to do to protect the nation. I mean, nobody ever did anything. No president ever limited constitutional freedoms more than Lincoln did during the war. He suspended habeas corpus. He took control of telegraph lines. He restricted the travel of anyone deemed a Confederate sympathizer. He allowed unwarranted, without warrants, arrests of people by the military. He confiscated the property of people who sympathized with the Confederacy. He permitted the arbitrary arrest and military trials of citizens, people who weren't in the military. He severely restricted free speech as well. And in almost all cases, Lincoln had the backing of the courts. Besides wars, strikes, economic crises, and fear of communism have each, in their own context, in their own time, been deemed an urgent need that has allowed the government to go time and again outside the Constitution in order to reach whatever goal it felt it had to go, you know, reach. It allowed the president to do this, to do what he wanted to do. I have a report written by two former U.S. senators. It was a U.S. Senate report on the emergency powers. Because apparently there's hundreds and hundreds of these laws. And listen to what, this was former Senator Frank Church and Charles Mathias. And this is what they said regarding emergency powers. This, again, this is a U.S. Senate report. This isn't some kooky militia. Okay, this is a, it says the United States thus has on the books at least 470 significant emergency power statutes without time limitation, delegating to the executive branch executive extensive discretionary powers ordinarily exercised by the legislature, which affects the lives of American citizens in a host of all-encompassing ways. This vast range of powers, taken together, confer enough authority to rule this country without reference to normal constitutional processes. These laws make no provision for congressional oversight, nor do they reserve to Congress a means for terminating the temporary emergencies which trigger them into use. The report warned, finally, quote, because emergency powers used in the past have tended to be authoritarian in nature, they pose a serious threat to the American democratic government. Close quote. Now, what does all this mean? Well, first of all, neither Scripture nor the spirit of prophecy detail what legalities are going to be used to justify end-time persecution. And I've said this before, you know, Revelation paints some very broad strokes about America's role in prophecy. Revelation gives almost no details whatsoever. Ellen White, through the spirit of prophecy, comes in and gives us more details. But really, you go back and read it, even her descriptions of America and so forth in the last days, they're still quite broad strokes. The details haven't been given, so we don't know how it's going to happen. But the mechanisms are in place and precedents have been set. If President Hayes in 1877 could use emergency powers to deal with a railroad strike, you know, what would happen if the nation were suddenly reeling under the, quote, the judgments of God? And according to prophecy, it's precisely that, the fear of God's judgments, that will ignite persecution. Again, I have to quote Ellen White in Great Controversy. It will be declared that men are offending God by violation of the Sunday Sabbath, that the sin has brought calamities which will not cease until Sunday observance shall be strictly enforced, and that those who present the claims of the fourth commandment, thus destroying reverence for Sunday, are troublers of the people, preventing their restoration to divine favor and temporal prosperity. Those who honor the Bible Sabbath will be denounced as enemies of law and order, as breaking down the moral restraints of society, causing anarchy and corruption, and calling down the judgments of God upon the earth. And again, if fear of Japan, and I'm not downplaying that, I imagine, I'm looking out here, I imagine many of you remember that. Remember that. And it was probably a very, very frightening time. But that's the point. It was a frightening time. How many of you have never, ever been in a desperate situation where you just found yourself doing things that under normal circumstances you would never do? Who has never been in that? Now, did you guys get inundated with the snow last, was it bad here? I mean, I remember people just got nasty. You know, they were blocked in and people were in the stores trying to get food and so forth. And people just got nasty because they were uptight. You know, things were different. Things are, the buildings were closed and you couldn't get on the roads and you were trapped and this and that. I mean, that's just a snowstorm. But I remember my wife and I, we both thought about it. We were in this long line in Giant. You have Giants here? Yeah, this is Piggly Wiggly country, isn't it? Is that Piggly Wiggly country? Yeah. I think it gets south of the Mason-Dixon line. Piggly Wiggly's. I always got a kick out of that name. But I mean, we were in these long lines, just to buy bread. And, you went to the shelves and there wasn't even bread on the shelves. And that's like when I was in Russia years and years ago. You can even find bread on the shelves. And people got uptight. They got nasty. They were fights. Just because people got desperate, things changed. Now, with our present government, and with the separation of church and state still intact, despite efforts of various people, including a certain senator from a certain state whose name I'm not going to mention, despite their efforts, church-state separation is still intact. As long as that's intact, this scenario seems unlikely. But of course, there are people out there who want to change the concept of separation of church and state. They want to change, such as the New Christian Right, which openly avows its animosity to church-state separation. They openly speak out against church-state separation. And with those goals accomplished, church-state separation were ever destroyed, which ultimately it's going to be, then prophecy could be very quickly fulfilled. Now, as I said, if the U.S. Supreme Court found enough compelling state interest in I'm not going to get into that. I don't want to deviate on that. Let me read you another quote. This is a quote from columnist Molly Ivins. She talked about after the Oklahoma City bombing. She said, "The impulse to make ourselves safer by making ourselves less free is an old one. Even here, when we were badly frightened, we think that we can make ourselves safer by sacrificing some of our liberties. We did it during the McCarthy era out of fear of communism. Less liberty is regularly proposed as a solution to crime, to pornography, to illegal immigration, to abortion, to all kinds of threats." And she wrote this after the Oklahoma City bombing. Now you remember, after that bombing in Oklahoma, an immediate reaction arose. I mean, it was scary. It was scary. I mean, if it could happen in Oklahoma, it could happen anywhere. An immediate action arose from some to stifle rights in an attempt to stop domestic terrorism. And it's understandable. I mean, however tragic that explosion was, this was one bomb, one building, and it killed less people than who die per day from smoking cigarettes. Imagine tragedies that kill 10 times or 100 times as many people. What would our reaction be? What would our reaction be, especially if it's close to home, especially if we believe that these tragedies were somehow the result of God's judgments on the nation? Of course, it would be out of character and unconstitutional, at least as the way our Constitution is interpreted now, for our government to make theological pronouncements, such as the fact that a certain calamity or certain disaster is a judgment of God, and then to make laws based on those pronouncements. You know, government in America is supposed to be neutral toward religion. And pronouncing, for example, that a flood is the wrath of God against the nation for, let's say, abortion or pornography, and then outlawing those things in response is not neutrality, but enforcement of a specific theological position. Yet the thing we have to remember is that no matter how lofty the principles, no matter how wonderful the Constitution is and all this, Our government is made of individuals. Individuals who make and enforce and interpret these laws, who interpret the Constitution. These are individuals who face the same fears as you and I and everybody else. I mean, if someone's house is destroyed by a flood, or his family is destroyed or killed in an earthquake, neutrality, this concept of neutrality, even for a Supreme Court justice, isn't going to be the overwhelming sentiment, especially if that person believes he knows the cause of the flood, if he really believed it was a judgment of God or something. Again, if a majority of U.S. Supreme Court justices could get so caught up in the post-Pearl Harbor hysteria that they gave their constitutional blessings to the imprisonment and internment of 120,000 people. No crimes, whatever. What would now some of these justices do if one day they woke up and the Potomac River was floating through their living room, destroying their home, taking away their family? See, even now, our country has recognized the existence of God. Pennies minuted U.S. government display in God We Trust. The Pledge of Allegiance says one nation under God. The first Congress of the United States elected a chaplain and it passed a resolution recommending to the people of the United States a day of public thanksgiving and prayer to be observed by acknowledging with grateful hearts the many signal favors of the Almighty God. Even some Supreme Court decisions have acknowledged the existence of God. We are a religious people whose institutions suppose a supreme being, wrote Justice Douglas in a famous U.S. Supreme Court case. But even more important than that, at least from a prophetic standpoint, is that the vast majority of Americans, by far the largest percentage in the Western industrialized world, believes in God. Somewhere up to 94% of people in this country believe in God, which is astounding. I mean, I imagine you go over to England and Scandinavia, you probably find the percentage is half that. In Scandinavia, it'd probably even be less. I remember I used to live in Sweden, and some Swede told me one time that, but Scandinavia, that is a godless place. That really is. I mean, even when I was a teenager and wasn't even a believer, I mean, I was about as spiritual as a head of cabbage. I noticed what a godless place this was. And someone told me one time that the Soviet commissars or whatever, they came over to Sweden one time and they asked the Swedish government, how have you been able to do it? We can't do it. And they wanted to know how the Scandinavians were able to eliminate religion from their country. And it was, well, I think the real answer was easy because it was all a state church. They had church and state together and it just basically helped destroy it. That's my understanding of it. Historian Gary Wills, writing about this amazing phenomena in this country, he said, technology, urbanization, social mobility, universal education, high living standards, all were supposed to eat away at religion in a wash of overlapping acids. But each has crested over America, proving itself a solvent or catalyst in other areas, but showing little power to corrode or diminish religion. The figures are staggering. Poll after poll confirm them. 9 out of 10 Americans say they have never doubted the existence of God. 8 Americans in 10 say they believe they will be called before God on Judgment Day to answer for their sins. 8 Americans in 10 believe God still works miracles. Now, we all know that not everyone who believes in God or even professes religion is a born-again Christian filled with the Holy Spirit. On the contrary, I would say most aren't. I mean, if it's so funny how, you know, the new Christian right, they love to talk all the time about how many religious people in America and how many religious people. Well, if they're so religious, why is the country going to hell in a handbasket? You know, you got all these, you know, that 98% American, you know, they try to say all this stuff, and yet, you know, we have the highest crime rate in the world, highest prison population per capita, the highest divorce rate, and on and on and on and on and on. And you find a lot of these things in the, quote, Christian community as well. Some of the greatest atrocities in history have been committed by religious people, even those adhering to the right religion. Religious people, remember, it was religious people worshiping the right religion. They had the right religion, worshiping the true God who hung Jesus on a cross. These statistics up here I find incredible. George Gallup, who's a Christian, has shown that most Americans who profess Christianity don't know the basics of their faith. And even more distressingly, Gallup has showed time and again that these people professing Christianity don't act a whole lot different. They're just as liable to lie and to steal and to cheat on their taxes as the unchurched. Time and again, Gallup polls have showed this. And he talked about their ignorance of Christian, of what they believe. You ought to read some of the Gallup polls on that sometimes. About, you know, the percentage of Christians who don't even know who preached the Sermon on the Mount. The percentage of Christians who couldn't name you 5 of the 10 commandments. And he goes on, he says, Gallup says, this ignorance, he warned, is a very frightening situation. Because not being grounded in one's faith, he said, we're open for anything that comes along, including, no doubt, the demagogues, who during economic or natural disasters will warn that these troubles are the judgments of God. And yet, what makes it even more difficult is, in one sense, these demagogues will be correct. From the flood to the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah to God's warnings to Nineveh, Egypt, and Babylon and a host of other pagan nations, I mean, the Bible clearly teaches that God's judgments do fall on rebellious nations. And I've got a couple of Bible quotes here that I'm not going to read it, but what I'll read you is what Ellen White. Ellen White herself clearly warns about the judgments of God falling upon the world and even upon the United States. Here's Ellen White. The point is fast being reached when the iniquity of transgressors will be to the full. God gives nations a certain time of probation. He sends light and evidence that, if received, will save them. But if refused, indignation and punishment will fall upon them. The Lord God will soon arise in His wrath and pour out His judgments upon those who are repeating the sins of the inhabitants of the Noahic world. Here she writes again, it is thus that God deals with nations. Though a certain period of probation, through a certain period of probation, He exercises long suffering towards nations, cities, and individuals. But when it is evident that they will not come unto Him that they might have life, judgments will be visited upon them. And I want to read you another one, one more. We are admonished by the nearness of the end, by the calamity that has befallen San Francisco. Christ declared that earthquakes and other judgments will be seen in diverse places. But by these He desires to demonstrate that He hates iniquity and that He will punish transgressors. He will forbear and forbear and forbear, but finally He can forbear no longer. Now, if Ellen White could warn about immorality back then, you know, a century before Ozzie and Harriet, you know, Leave It to Beaver, and Leave It a Beaver, what would she say today? You know, in an era of Hustler magazine, MTV, and crack cocaine. In many ways, her words do echo the Falwell and the Robertsons and the Kennedys and these others, which also warn about God's judgment falling on the nation because of sin and iniquity. However much we will disagree with these Christians, over the cause and the solution, particularly the solution, that'll happen particularly after the mark of the beast comes in effect. For now, the new right, these people have a valid point when it warns about God's judgments falling upon iniquity and lawlessness. I mean, however much I can't stand those people, they do have a point there when they talk about that. If Ellen White in her day could write that already the judgments of God are abroad in the land, as seen in storms and floods, in tempests and earthquakes, in peril by land and sea. I mean, considering the incredible decadence, immorality, and violence of contemporary America today, men like Robertson and Falwell and Brother Dobson, they are not too far off in some of their pronouncements and warnings either. Make sense? The question is not, though, can the supposed judgments of God be used by our government to one day suppress Sabbath keepers? That's not the question. We know that it's going to happen. What we don't know are the exact legal mechanisms that will be used to justify that suppression. Whether it'll be Emergency Powers Act or whether, you know, the court will come in and do something. I mean, who knows? We don't know. We just simply have not been told. At least nothing I can find anywhere in the Bible or the Spirit of Prophecy. However it comes, history, such as what happened to the Japanese in this country, proves that even in free America, in order to preserve its best interests, this nation will trample on our constitutional protections. You know, the bottom line is that under the right conditions, anything can happen. So however much we enjoy the freedoms now, it's because things are not that bad. But let things get bad, and boom, everything can change overnight. And you know, again, I tend to think too, knowing Americans, and what Revelation, you know, there's an economic motif in Revelation. And, you know, you can do what you want. You can take our people hostage. You can blow us up. You can do a lot of things to this country. But don't mess with our pocketbooks. Now, that's just America. Okay? And again, I don't make predictions. I'm very careful about that, because I've done them and I've been wrong and I've learned my lesson. So I've learned my lesson on that. But if I were to guess, if I can think of anything that could just turn this country, make the lamb speak like a dragon, if I were to guess, I would say it would be something economic. Particularly, not only because of just the American character, but the fact that, you know, you've got this economic motif in the book of Revelation. And, you know, time and again, the Sabbath, or you read literature. I get this magazine Sunday, put out by the Lord's Day Alliance. And, you know, it's really kind of, you got to almost feel sorry for these people. They're so sincere. and their desire to see the Lord's Day, you know, and they're just, you know, I mean, it's this tiny little frumpy little magazine, but right now, I mean, this Sunday and this whole thing is just a dead issue. But time and again in their magazine, they talk about the economics involved, how God blesses these people, you know, whatever. I forgot, some fast food chicken place or something. What is it? Chick-fil-A? That's around here. The guy, you know, adamantly closes his business on, you know, they always have something in there about this Chick-fil-A. Chick-fil-A. Ugh, sounds gross. I just imagine some greasy little... But whatever it was, they talk about it all the time, how he's been blessed. So you see, when you read the stuff on Sunday, it's tied in with economics, which is the way, in a sense, we would do Sabbath as well. No, they got it so much that they got it good, they just have the wrong day. But they got a lot of other of it. Makes a lot of sense. So if I were to guess on anything, it would seem to me economics. And of course, I'm not, you know, every year you got, you know, the coming crash of 1993 and 1995, you know, and on and on and on. Every week, you know, a new book out about the coming crash and so forth. And, you know, but again, if you think about what the Bible says and what Spirit of Prophecy says about American prophecy, there's going to have to be a major change in our attitudes. But again, as when you look at what happened in the Second World War, it doesn't even take a whole lot to bring about these changes. Telling about her experience in one of the internment camps in the 1940s as a young woman, just uprooted from her home, just taken away everything, lost everything, and put in this camp. This Emmy Somakawa warned about the future. I like to close with this before we go to questions. We've got some time here for questions. She warned, and this is what she said. I hope that something like this will never happen again, will never happen to another group of people. But sometimes I wonder. And I think she's got good reason to wonder.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.